This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
But the fight has to be against corporations, and we are, our members are part of that fight.
In April, more than 1,100 garment workers were killed and more than 2,000 injured in the Rana Plaza manufacturing facility building collapse in Dhaka, Bangladesh. 2 weeks later, a fire at another garment factory killed 7. And late last year, more than 100 were killed in the Tazreen factory fire. Labor advocates say all these deaths and injuries were preventable. Munami Malik is the executive director of a New York City-based non-profit organization, Desi's Rising Up and Moving, or DRUM, which also helps Bangladeshi workers. Malik recently visited Bangladesh and met with some workers there.
Mainly the people I talked to were 14, 15, 16-year-old girls. There's a majority of the people who are killed in these tragedies, and they're all poor young girls who are coming from villages for jobs, sending money back to support their families. I think that the nation there, the business owners, people who have any sort of respect for human rights should be standing up for the workers. I think people here who care about how our clothing is made, why we have cheap products, at what cost, at the cost of human lives, should care and force the corporations here to do the right thing.
So far, only 43 multinational brands and retailers, including Sweden's H&M and New York-based Abercrombie & Fitch, have signed on to the Worker Safety Agreement. Salim Rizvi, FSRN, New York City.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.
The time is 6:01, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio. Please stay tuned for Labor Radio, and after that, Prison Pipeline.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
I'm Bobby Davis. After a life of crime and addiction and 18 years in prison, I...
KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast the 26th annual Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. Thursday through Sunday, July 4th through 7th, KBOO will be broadcasting live from Tom McCall Waterfront Park for the Portland metro area and throughout the state with our partners in Ashland, Bend, Newport, Salem, Warm Springs, and more. Internet listeners can tune in to KBOO.fm. Again, that's the 26th annual Waterfront Blues Festival, a benefit for the Oregon Food Bank, because no one should be hungry. More information on costs, benefit to KBOO members, performing artists, and more can be found at KBOO.fm.
July 1st, 2013. Station Navigator Report. Thank you, listeners. We had an overwhelming response to the recent program survey. 1,130 people submitted responses to the question, "Do you want to hear Tom Hartman on KBOO?" 764 people responded yes. That's 67%. 366 people responded no. That's 32%. There were 1,127 responses to the question, "Are you a KABU member?" 640 people responded yes, 57%. 487 people responded no, 43%. There were responses to the survey left via phone messages, called in by listeners, emails, and given verbally at the station. These responses, split pretty evenly for and against the Hartman Show, were not included in the online results. However, next time we will have a secure way for listeners and members to respond who do not have access to a computer. This was just an information gathering survey, the results of which are now being turned over to the Programming Committee for discussion. The next meeting of the Program Committee will be Tuesday, July 9th at 6 p.m. at KABU. Thanks again for your thoughtful comments, suggestions, and remarks associated with the survey and what you think should be aired on KABU. This has been Lynn Fitch.
Taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. Cha-cha-cha. It's the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, KABU's all-vinyl guilty pleasure. Monday nights, midnight to 1 a.m. on 90.7 FM stereo and around the world at KBOO.FM.
Tune in next week for Labor Radio at this same time. But tonight we have special programming for you. This is going to be a program about WINGS, about the UK strike, miners' strike in the 80s.
Today on WINGS, the upshot of the miners' strike that racked the United Kingdom in the years 1984 and 85, and its effect on women in the Nottinghamshire village of Blidduth.
And so in terms of the gender politics of what happened, everything that sort of, you know, as a feminist or women's liberationist you would want, really, pretty much happened.
It's the second and final part of a series.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to WINGS, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Welcome to Women on the Line, Community Radio's National Women's Current Affairs Program, produced at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne and broadcast on the Community Radio Network. I'm Elena McMaster. Stay with us for the next half hour as we mark the death of former British PM Margaret Thatcher by remembering the legacy of some of the women who struggled against her New World Order and pausing to mourn the legacy of that New World Order.
The defeat of the miners' strike still hung heavily over England, like a dark cloud.
This week, we're bringing you the second part of our interview with writer, socialist and feminist Lynn Beaton, who lived and struggled alongside the people of Blidduth in Nottinghamshire during the brutally repressed miners' strike in 1984-85. Miners across the north of England were striking to try and prevent the economic rationalisation of their industry, which meant pit closures, thousands of jobs lost, and the decimation of rural villages. The strike was not won. The effect was both devastating and insidious.
Blidduth is next to Sherwood Forest. And in Blidduth, Maid Marian is supposed to have been born, and Will Scarlett is actually buried in the Blidduth Cemetery. And so it's a very Robin Hood place. and most of the pubs have Robin Hood-type names. You know, so there's the Jolly Friar and the... and I can't remember the rest. I don't think there's a Maid Marian pub and I can't remember anyway. But there was maybe 8 or 9 pubs in Blidduth. And they were all traditional English pubs and they all had the feel and the atmosphere of old traditional pubs, which, you know, everyone who's been to England knows that one of the nice things about England is the old traditional... the feel of the old traditional pubs. And let's say the heart and soul lives in those old traditional pubs. So most of the pubs are now closed in the village. And for Doreen, you know, she lives there and these things happen and for me, I pop in once every few years, and I notice big changes that she perhaps doesn't notice, because for her they creep up. So one time we went there, and she said, "Oh, I want to take you out somewhere for lunch. There's this new place I can take you for lunch." And we went in the car out of the village, where most of the pubs have closed down, to a parking lot on the corner of two massive, great big roads, you know, highway type things, not motorways, but, you know, big highways, the cars speeding by. We pull into the car park, and all there is this car park and a great big red brick building. And then we went inside the red brick building, and inside it was complete transformation, because it was a fake Sherwood Forest pub. And, you know, you've seen the fake Irish pubs. We've all seen all the fake pubs that there are around the place now. And so it was just like that. And the menu was some sort of fake wax, you know, thing with fake would-be Robin Hood time, you know, menus. And for me, that epitomised absolutely the loss of the soul of Blitis. And hello, here we come, the illusion of neoliberalism.
But the struggle, the 12-month-long strike that in Blitis was effectively led by the women, did transform people and communities. Lynn Beaton's book, called Shifting Horizons, brings us two staunch voices from Blitis, Doreen and Pauline, neighbours, miners' wives and strike leaders. We rejoin Lynn to chat about housework and the breaking down of previously gendered divisions of labour during the strike.
Pip, in particular, Doreen's husband, became a very fussy housekeeper. And when you ate in the house, you know, he'd be almost hanging around you with a cloth to wipe up any crumb that you might drop. They would get bitchy with each other, the men, because everything was shared. So vacuum cleaners in particular, as a vacuum cleaner broke down, then you know, have to share a vacuum cleaner, and then more vacuum cleaners would break down, and so the parts of the vacuum cleaners would possibly be put together to make some sort of hybrid vacuum cleaner, and so these things were shared, and so you'd go to some house and the man would be moaning about the fact that he'd got the vacuum cleaner off such and such another man yesterday and was full of dog hairs, and why didn't he clean the vacuum cleaner? So the men did get very picky and very fussy about keeping the houses clean, and also very appreciative of their wives, very aware of the fact that they had to do the housework and be the prime carers for the kids, because the women's role was increasingly taking the women away from the village. Mm. And that was in order to keep the support high. Increasingly there were legal cases, because the number of arrests were massive. And so the women made it a point to go to the court cases to give moral support to whoever was being charged and their family.
I remember also that the men expressed a great deal of appreciation for being able to finally spend some time with their children, because they, you know, many of them were working 5 or even 7 day weeks, and yeah, you know, that work is pretty brutal and hard, and so they'd always be too tired when they got home. But with the strike, they were, because they became primary caregivers, they were able to finally spend some time with their kids.
No, it's true. And so in terms of the gender politics of what happened, everything that sort of, you know, as a feminist or women's liberationist you would want, really, pretty much happened. That, because, you know, pit villages in Nottinghamshire, and well, pit villages anywhere, I think, but in Nottinghamshire in particular, where they were very conservative, gender politics were pretty ugly. And the changing of them is all the more significant. I mean, everyone, the men as well as the women, are in this situation where the way that they thought, the place that they thought they had in society, that has been taken away from them. So in a sense, then once it becomes evident that that that's the case, it's not such a big leap for gender issues to be raised. And that the raising of that came from the material circumstances of the fact that the women were taking the stronger roles, and they were becoming the people who were providing the sustenance, the physical sustenance and the emotional sustenance for the strike to continue.
I wanted to ask you about what you saw and experienced and also what you were told about in terms of the state's effort to try and break the strike. And you've already mentioned briefly the siege. Yeah, but if you're able to talk to us any more about some of the stuff that Doreen and Pauline particularly talk about experiencing with the police intimidation and brutality.
Well, yes. It was sort of hard to believe. And I think, you know, I think that a lot of people, possibly, you know, a lot of people listening now will have experienced police brutality. And so they will know what that's like. But they will have mostly experienced police brutality because they went to an event because of their particular beliefs. You know, they went to an event to protest something or to support something and they were attacked by the police. Whereas in this situation, the police basically invaded the village of Blidders. And they invaded every aspect of people's lives. They arrested people for absolutely no reason. And they didn't just arrest them on... They arrested people on the picket lines. They also just picked them up in the street. They also intimidated people on the street all the time by asking them... you know, where are you going, where do you come from, you know, and so on. I personally was terrified walking around the streets. There were everywhere you walked, there were police walking around. You didn't have to go near the pit to find a policeman. They were just everywhere. And on the picket lines, they would, you know, they would obviously stand in a line between the pickets and the scabs going into work. But at any given time, and I saw this several times, they would just turn around and attack. There would be no provocation whatsoever. They would turn around and attack people. Doreen and Pauline, before I got there, witnessed a Yorkshire picket beaten up almost to a pulp in front of their house by, I think, 8 or 9 police on one man. Everywhere miners went, they were stopped in their cars. Where are you going? Show us your license. Just all this general intimidation. The shift changed on Sundays. The shift changed on Monday mornings. And if you went up the motorway from London on a Sunday, the whole of the left lane would be the slow, snail-crawling blue vans. And in each blue van, there would be 13 police. And these were just the police going up, you know, to the pit villages to control them, to invade them, basically. It went on day after day after day. So, you know, the violence was really intense and continuous.
Why is Daddy crying, Mum? Has he got a pooly head? Was it done by men in blue when they dragged us out of bed? No, son. He's shedding tears of pride in the medals he has won. Nay, lad, they're not across his chest. They're out there, every one. Workers cheering in the streets. Supporters filling every hall, sending food by lorry load, responding to the call. Every worker's contribution, no matter if it's small, everyone's a medal, lad, responding to the call. Every tin, a hope expressed, that we will see it through. Every single coin, a prayer, that scabs will one day rue. So when the battle's over, when the Tories are no more, the world will still remember 1984.
What will become of this pit yard, where men once trampled faces hard? So tired and weary their shit done,
never having seen the sun.
Across Australia, you're listening to Women on the Line on the Community Radio Network. You can find us online at womenontheline.org.au. Subscribe to the podcast at 3cr.org.au/podcasts or connect with the program on Facebook and Twitter.
Way beneath this pit head here, empty trucks once filled with coal, lined up like men on the dole.
This week on Women on the Line, we're celebrating the passing of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher by remembering some of those who fought so hard against her New World Order. Writer and unionist Lynn Beaton joins us to talk about the women who held the 84-85 miners' strike in the small town of Blidiff in Nottinghamshire. I asked Lynn to talk about the eventual loss, the end of the strike, and the legacy that's been left behind by the women of Blidiff.
Well, in Blidiff, from about the 6 month mark, people started drifting back to work for various reasons, but it's just very hard to sustain when they're in a minority and they're, you know, and they can't see any end to it. You know, the business of maintaining morale is hard to believe because, you know, as I've mentioned, you had all of the media against you. They'd watch the television news, they'd read newspapers. All of these would be telling them that there was no hope. There was news, you know, that Thatcher had stockpiled enough coal to get her through one winter, and they all said she can't get through the second winter. So, then once she got through one winter, word was out she could get through another winter. And because people's lives were so terribly disrupted, and living in the sort of way that they did is wearing. You know, we all know ourselves. When something, some change, unpleasant change is forced on our lifestyles, it sort of wears you down. And so all of these things, and in the end, bit by bit, you know, people would drop out. But still the strike was reasonably solid. I mean, this wasn't by any means a majority of people. But the National Union actually decided that they had more to gain by making a, what was the word they used, a sort of respectful end to the strike. Rather than letting it dribble away to nothing, that they should call it off and say that, you know, what they wanted to do now was to go into a period of negotiation. And so they advised that they should go back to work. It was shocking. They couldn't believe that, that the NUM was saying to them, go back.
So Doreen and Pauline both said that they would continue to struggle to lift the working class, I guess, to build and defend their communities. Can you tell us about what happened to them after the strike ended and their husbands went back to work in the pits and what happened to their communities?
They both... they continued, I think, the focus of all of the pit communities all over England when the strike ended was on the jailed miners, and so there was they all launched campaigns to have the jailed miners freed, and so that was the main focus in Blidworth also, that they set up committees to free the jailed miners, and they visited the jailed miners, and they made lots of publicity to support free the jail miners campaign. There were several miners from Blidiff who were in jail, in particular Ken Petty, who was in for quite a long stretch because of the GBH. And then they all joined the local branch. Well, they all, I think 60 of people from Blidiff joined the local branch of the Labor Party as soon as the strike ended. And they decided that was the way that they wanted to become politically active, and that was the way they should do that. Doreen stood for and was elected as a local councillor, and she, in doing that, she was very, very clear that what she wanted to struggle for were community community empowerments. You know, so it might be, and what she actually achieved was, because she saw the strike centre as having been in itself, apart from everything else that happened, she saw that the strike centre, the existence of the strike centre, as a place where people could come together, could meet together, could give each other strength and support, that that in itself was an empowerment. And so she fought on council and won the fact that they built a community centre in Blitheth, which is still there. However, that all sort of probably went on for about maybe 5 years. But they're living still in Thatcher's Britain. And so all over Britain still, the attacks are going on. You know, they shifted from the miners, then they shifted to the printers at Wapping. You know, then they shifted to a whole bunch of... there were factory closures going on up and down England. Then they shifted to the poll tax and so on. So, and all, basically all of these struggles were lost. And so generally over the whole of Britain comes a sort of a hopelessness starts to, a sense of hopelessness, you know, starts to, a sense of, well, demoralisation, I suppose is the best word, starts to seep around everywhere. They became increasingly what Thatcher always wanted them to be, which was individuals, isolated individuals. The women's roles, but as women didn't have so much role anymore because they didn't work, you know, once the strike was over, that everything that happened to do with miners happened at work. And so they did, you know, as I said, for quite some time they tried to do stuff in the community, but sooner or later, it all fell away. The pit was closed. I can't remember how many, but maybe 5 years after the end of the strike, that Blitheth pit was closed. I remember talking to Pip, Doreen's partner, on the phone. I was in Australia when that happened, and I remember talking to him on the phone. He was very, very sad. He'd been brought up in Blitheth. His father had worked at the pit. He'd gone into the pit when he was 16. And you know, the contradiction is that it's pretty horrible work. But when it's been your whole life and your whole livelihood. And, you know, the miners had a really strong culture that they were very proud of. And so the closure of pits meant the end of that culture, really.
You're listening to Lynn Beaton. She lived in a mining village in England during the coal strike of the 1980s and published a book about women's role in that strike called Shifting Horizons in 1985. In 2013, Beaton recalls that story upon the death of the woman who broke that strike, Margaret Thatcher. The interviewer is Elena McMaster. In the next segment, Beaton mentions the GFC, that's the global financial crisis.
It's very timely, in a sense, that this death of Thatcher, you know, because it brings on a revisiting of what happened around the period of the introduction of neoliberalism. And we've now seen where neoliberalism takes us, you know, to its most extreme in the GFC. And we're still, all of us, living with the legacy of neoliberalism. And so, you know, and hopefully we're living now through the end of it, because it's been exposed for everyone to see now. And now it's time, I think, very, very much for a revisitation of the sorts of struggles that went on to stop it coming in, which were lost. But perhaps now that it's run its course, it's timely for those struggles to be reenacted, regenerated. Anyway.
So would you like to tell us first a bit about what you've heard of Doreen's grandchildren kind of rediscovering their grandma's legacy?
A couple of months ago now, I heard from Karen, who's Doreen's daughter, who is actually features quite strongly in Shifting Horizons. She's 18 when Shifting Horizons was written during the strike. She's 18, and she has a baby boy called Ricky, just after Christmas. And so Ricky's now, you know, almost 30. And Karen said to me, I got a quick Facebook message from Karen saying, "Hey, Lynn, Ricky's reading Shifting Horizons. He thinks it's brilliant." And so I was, of course, very excited. And then the next thing, I got a Facebook message from another of Doreen's grandchildren, Amy, who said, I'm reading Shifting Horizons. It's absolutely fantastic. I can't put it down. Anyway, then gradually, one after another, all of Doreen's children read it. And none of them had a clue that any of this was in their family history, because it had ended in defeat, and because Doreen had, you know, sort of hadn't talked to her grandchildren about it. I suppose, you know, it happens over and over in families that when people do things which are so completely out of their normal, you know, life routines, sometimes they just don't bring those things up and talk about them. Anyway, so the continuity of that struggle is now exists in that family as a result of the grandkids reading the book, which I think is very exciting.
Yep. So, Lynn, I want to ask you about the legacy that you think that Doreen and Pauline and the other women who were involved in the miners' strike in 84 and 85, what that kind of legacy they've left for women today.
Okay, I think that legacy is enormous, and I think that there's a historical legacy, and which is much bigger than I think we often think about. I see that the first major onslaught against the British working class, and the primary onslaught against the British working class, was the onslaught against the miners by Thatcher, and the fact. You know, history is a very strange creature, and the fact that that onslaught was actually led by a woman, and then the fact that the main and the strongest opposition against that onslaught ended up being the women in the pit villages. That's left us a legacy that women are not somehow somewhere other fighting only for women's rights. Or only for childcare, or only for, you know, if these things are only women's rights, but you know what I mean. That actually women are